We have been going in the book of Ezekiel to try and understand some things about who God is, what he is. For the most part, I think religionists throughout the centuries of history have tended to classify God and build their own image of him. They try to maybe put him into human terms too much. And the result is that we have some very, I should almost say, absurd images of God, absurd ideas about God, what he is, who he is, what he does. And yet, we're all in the same basic boat. That is that from a human perspective, coming at the thing from human thinking, how in the world can we know anything about God? How? I've said before, it's like an ant crawling on a boot and trying from that to put together an image of a man. Now, we have help in it. We have help, and that's in the Bible. This has been a collection of ideas, of literature, over a period of 1,600 years, a collection of writings about God. And this is what we have based our Christian religion on. It's in the interpretation of these writings that we have difficulty. And so we have a large collection of ideas, some of them probably quite sound, some of them not. But a collection of ideas throughout the history of man who has sought constantly for centuries to understand God. In fact, one of the things that gives me personally the conviction that there is such a one as God is that all through human history people have had that out there that they've been seeking for. If God had not implanted in the human creature something of himself, we would not constantly be rising to find God any more than an ant has a conviction to find out what a human being is like, because he could crawl all over a human being all day and never have a composite, because an ant cannot get out far enough to see a human being, nor can he communicate with human beings in any way. I think I've said somewhere before that you have people trying to communicate with animals, cats and dogs. I've seen on television once in a while people up there talking with a cat, trying to tell the audience what the cat is saying. I wouldn't want to be regarded as inhumane here toward animals, but I don't think that our conversation with them is all that enlightening. But even if we wanted to talk with ants, maybe you can do with a dog or a cat. I think dogs might be sensitive to voice changes and whatnot. They seem to learn what certain things mean, and they do them sometimes. They're well trained. But that's a moot point. The degree to which a dog or a cat really understands what a human psyche is all about, that's a moot point. I'm not going to argue it, because you may think your animal is very intelligent. Probably is. But no one would argue the point that if you try to talk to an ant, you're going to have trouble. Now you have to see the same problem with God talking to man. The difference is we're not all that interested in communicating with ants, nor have we the capacity to communicate spirit to them. God apparently has the will and the capacity to share his spirit with us. Else we would not even have the vaguest notion of the word God. But universally, whether people agree with God or don't agree with God, I mean whether they believe in him or don't believe in him, everybody knows who you're talking about. And nobody is denying nothing. If a person says, oh well, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in God, what is it he's not believing in? He must have some idea of what he doesn't believe in. And I've used the illustration from the world of auto mechanics. When you've got an apprentice, sometimes the owner wants to show the parts department that he's a novice, and so he sends the young fellow for a hyperdeucinator. Now, what is a hyperdeucinator? It's nothing. The moment he steps up to the counter, the parts company says, "I want a hyperdeucinator," they know he's a greenhorn, right? That minute. And then they may lead him into a merry chase. That may not be very nice to do, but it's what they do. But nobody is going to deny the existence. I'm going to worry about the existence of a hyperdeucinator because they don't even know what it is. It's nothing. There is no such animal. So that's just a nonsense word. Hyperdeucinator is a nonsense word. Like some of the nonsense rhymes of Alice in Wonderland and some of these others. But God is not a nonsense word. Because even those who deny God put some kind of image to what it is, or sense to what it is they're denying. I'm saying to you, the Creator, God Himself, had to have put into the minds of people something of Himself for us to even work around the subject. If that is true, that our only way to really know God is if He communicates with us in His Spirit, we have to also then be very careful about how much we humans try to put propositions together about God, to say God is this or He is that, or He is not this or He is not that. It isn't that we shouldn't do it. It is that we have to be very careful how much weight we put on what we personally think God is. But the reality of God goes beyond what we think He is. It doesn't matter what we think He is, really. He is what He is, whether we think it or not. I've said many times, you believe God because He is, not because He does things you think He ought to do, not because He acts the way good gods ought to act. You know, He is. You either believe He is or He isn't. And if He is, you believe in Him, or should believe in Him. As I've said, it's like the law of gravity. You may not like the law. You may wish you could jump off the roof and land lightly on your feet like a tabby cat, but you can't do that. And you may not like the law of gravity. You may shout at it for giving you a broken leg, but it's there. So God is there. Now, the Bible communicates to us about God and has for centuries, when it is followed generally, has given a fairly cohesive, reasonable statement about how human beings can and do relate to God. The only proof of it, or the only evidence of it, is that when you accept this and you put it into practice, if you accept the law of gravity and you live by it, you get along better. And you don't jump off roofs and so forth unless you are unhappy with your life or something. It isn't that you are necessarily better off financially or physically or anything, but there's something inside that is an anchor point that gives substance to your life as you follow in the concept that God exists. That's just a little bit philosophical, but I'm just trying to help us get some bearings here, because we're going to be reading a passage. You can look at a passage that's a little hard to understand from a human point of view. And the question is, where do we get our ideas of God? How do we know what we know about Him? And when I talk about these things with you, the ultimate intention is always to help you handle life. It's not to make you theologians or to make you think that you're better than anybody else. Or smarter than anybody else, but just to give you footing, you see. And I have to start, you know, really at a foundational point, because I think one problem in Christianity is that there's too much ethereal, too much ivory tower stuff. And people just get out into the stratosphere when they talk about the things of God, and it doesn't help much in their practical everyday life. So how do we apply these things? And that's what my hope and concern is as I talk about it. But I have to start where we are. And I have to start at the point that here we are, little ants on the earth, tiny specks on this tiny planet in the middle of space, and what have we to do with God any more than an ant has anything to do with humans except spoil our picnic. But the Bible indicates we do have to do with God, and God has things to do with us, and the Bible indicates that when we accept this point of the Spirit of God in us, when we accept His Spirit in us, there's a certain stabilizing of the human scene, a stabilizing of our minds perhaps, a point of reference, a point of reference. That's what we're looking for. So God is a point of reference in a world, in a universe that is vast and would be otherwise a hopeless sea of eternal nothingness apart from God. I'm going to remind you of an illustration I've used before, an analogy about the jets, airliners. When you think about it, it's an absurd thing that a couple hundred people sit in that tin can 30,000 feet above the earth and hope all the wires will stay together. See? It's absurd. Even to get on the unit is absurd. But we do it. And of course, we probably, most of us, cut away from being insane anyway. But I was thinking about it one day, and we were up there in a holding pattern because of conditions, and we were getting low on fuel and so forth. And someone thinks, well, now suppose you land safely, then where are you? You're on a little ball out over space. So what's the difference? You see? You're over nothing then in space. Now, there isn't much security for human beings. There isn't much security apart from that deep inner anchor point or sense that God is and that life is not absurd. Well, it's absurd on the earth. It's idiotic. But I mean that the thing that isn't absurd, the thing that isn't ridiculous, is that we all have spirits. And those spirits are tied to God. And that makes us eternal. And then it doesn't matter what happens to the earth or the jet in a lot of ways. What difference does it make? You only have a few years to live anyway, so I wouldn't get too excited if you shorten it a little bit. Wouldn't matter a whole lot. What difference, whether you 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 when you kick out. But this gives a stroke of realism to what it is we're doing. That's why often I've said I'm not religious, because I'm not trying to pursue God as some guru out here in the stratosphere. I'm trying to get hold of what is real in life and what you can bank on. You can't bank on much in this world. The only thing that is changeless is the idea of change, because everything changes. Whatever is all right today is going to be upside down tomorrow. But you can take courage that if it's upside down tomorrow, it'll be upside right the next day. Just the way life is. Where's our stability? I want to help you with that. Where is our stability? Stability is in God, not in our own notions of God. We have to have some forms here to look at or think about of God. I understand that. And the Bible gives that to us. But the Bible is not quite as explicit as to exactly what God is as some people would like to believe. Now, there is a generalization here of that God is eternal. Something has to be eternal. I think I'd rather have God eternal than an atom. An atom is sort of like a submicroscopic ant, maybe. I'd rather put my weight on an eternal God than an eternal atom. Say. But there is an eternal factor here to God, and we know that. And it's obvious from the Bible that God interacts with us. Else there wouldn't be any concept whatsoever of God any more than an ant has a concept of a man or a woman. But we do have some ideas about God that come from the Scripture, that He is eternal, that He interacts with us, that He has some ultimate purpose for us. That's important too. Else there would have been no reason for Him to communicate with us if He didn't have some ultimate purpose. the Bible becomes a totally useless thing if God does not have some kind of eternal purpose for man. So he does have that, and we look at that point. Now, in order to bring the meaning of God, who is a spirit, into human terminology, we have Christ, who has come on the scene. Jesus Christ was the extension of God. That is, he was God's person brought into human terms. That's what the essence of Christianity is. That's wherein it differs from other views, in that Jesus Christ became an object lesson, a revelation to us on the earth, so that what our sense of God is becomes confirmed in the meaning of Jesus Christ. And of course, this is where all morality and ethics in the world comes from. Ultimately, if God does not exist, there's no reason for anything of morality or ethics. Get what you can get while you can get it, and forget the rest. But why is it we have any care about others? That's, again, the Spirit of God in us. Apart from the Spirit of God, boy, the Lord knows there's enough selfishness in the world as it is. But apart from the Spirit of God in us, nobody would care about anyone, and they'd be fools to care about it, because the best thing to do is get what you can get, because the law of the jungle prevails. Apart from God, the law of the jungle prevails. Survival of the fittest. And it's better to be a lion than a gazelle. So as I've said, you can't blame the gazelle for not liking that relationship. It isn't a matter of saying, well, we'll have our own moral standards. There just wouldn't be any more than there's any out in the jungle, you see. Apart from God, spirit. But his spirit in us is what causes us to care about others. And a lot of people on this earth and in this country do care a lot about others, but they don't realize where that caring has come from originally. It's come from the Spirit of God. Else nobody would care about anybody, any more than the lion wonders if the poor gazelle has a family out there. Now, a big problem comes in when we try to get too precise about just exactly what God does and how he wants us to live and whatnot. There are a lot of guidelines that help us. But sometimes for the human brain to assess God, there's got to be more than just words, because words are not really all that adequate. I've said to you many times, we all have our own language. The brain, the cortex, the pattern on the cortex, all pretty well determine how we look even at the words we use. To a person in America, except in the university, the word communism is a dirty word, you see. But in Russia, the word capitalist is a dirty word. I'm being a little extreme about that. Don't fire me. We say things sometimes a little carelessly. But anyway, we bring our own meaning to the words we use. You think about many words that you use, and you're very comfortable with the word. Somebody else uses it, or you use it with somebody else, and they're not comfortable with what you've said. So people see things differently. It's like in this recent flap, I have to say it, with the Secretary of the Interior, Mr. Watt. If you've been around a bunch of men, and you've been out hunting, or you've been in the army, or you've been on a ranch, or whatever, or in the locker rooms, guys have a way of saying things that everybody understands is just ribbing. For example, you might say to a buddy, a good buddy, who's limping, "What's wrong with you, a lousy cripple?" You know. Now that's just pure dribble. You understand that, and they may say back, "Well, if you had half a brain, you'd understand." You know, that's the kind of exchange that goes on among guys everywhere. Now here's a fellow that indiscreetly uses it in public. But it might be a sense that he so accepted handicapped people that it wasn't really a problem, that he wasn't that sensitive. Now, he shouldn't have said that. But what I'm really saying to you is, the thing that rattled everybody was the word cripple. I doubt if the fellow himself really cared that he used that word. I doubt it. But you see that over one word, a guy's whole career goes down the drain. One word. And of course, the absurd thing about it, every fellow in that Senate has probably used the same kind of language at one time or another. It's just the way life is. And I think sometimes, when I tell you, when I was teaching, I taught at high school down in the South Central LA district. You may know that district. Manual Arts was a high school, 90% black. Great basketball team. But the interesting thing is this. I used to tell black jokes in the classroom. We used to have an exchange like that, 12th grade high school class, and they got a kick out of it. I remember once I was walking on the campus, and there were six fellows, black fellows, sitting on a wall. And I said, look at the six blackbirds sitting on the fence. And one of the fellows said to me, man, he said, if anybody else had said that, be in trouble. Well, what was the difference? There was such a free atmosphere of understanding between us that, you know, was no problem. I suppose today I'd have my throat cut for that. Those were days when people understood people. They were not so lily white and hypersensitive that they couldn't stand to hear a couple of words used, you know. But it illustrates a point. People hear the words according to their brain. And if they've got a certain pattern on their cortex, they've got a little scar there, a little jagged line on that graph, and you hit that jagged line, it'll go anywhere. As long as you stay in the squares, everything's all right. But you see, this is the way it is to try to understand faith, try to understand God, is difficult because we each speak a different language. And you can use a word in one circle that you can't use in another circle of people. How in the world, then, can we really take seriously our theological statements about God? I have to follow that by saying there is some area of understanding, else there would be no communication. Now, when you pick up the Bible, some things are very explicit. That's why we know, for example, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That's what the Bible says, if you believe the Bible. There might be a lot of implications to what we mean by sonship as far as God is concerned. But one thing is certain, Jesus Christ was the authorized representative and spiritual extension of God on the earth. And watching Jesus Christ at work gave us some idea of what God was like in his attitudes toward mankind. See? More than that, Jesus Christ, according to the scripture, gave his life as a sacrifice. And to this day, 2,000 years later, we still remember that sacrifice and have ceremonies and rituals and activities centered around that sacrifice. And in many circles, it's called a celebration. And that 2,000 years later, we recognize the sacrifice of Christ on the earth. The Bible also tells us that the sacrifice Christ made for mankind satisfied some factor in God's economy or attitude toward the world that now makes it possible for us to possess within us the Spirit of God. Ourselves, as Christ did, but not in the extent of Christ. Now, this is very clear in the Bible, and I don't think you'd find much disagreement with that in almost any branch of Christendom. And they all together today accept those general tenets that God is, that he is a spirit, that he's eternal, that he represented himself by Jesus Christ on the earth, and that through that episode, God made available to mankind on the earth his own personal relationship or his own spirit to us. That's where we are today. There are many things that are not quite so clear about who God is or what he is or who Christ is. It is also in the scripture, it is rather clear that there is a place of eternal abode for us, where we be with Christ for eternity. Most descriptions of that, the present day, have not been satisfying to me. That is, they've been humanized descriptions. When we try to describe heaven in terms of some celestial Disneyland, because we're space-time people, you see, anything we think with this skull has got to be a space-time thing. But when we finally are eternally with God, it's not going to be a space-time thing. It can't be. The universe is vast to us because we're locked into space and time. Once you could get outside of that into another dimension, that's no problem. But for us here today to try and describe heaven in specific terms is probably ludicrous. It's certainly not necessarily biblical. The Bible's not that specific. The words that we translate into human terms, like the word mansion, does not exist in the Bible. The Greek word simply means abode. Somebody put the word mansion, because in Old English, mansion didn't really necessarily mean a vast state. It meant more or less a dwelling place. They used to call a parsonage a manse in the Old English. And if you've ever been around parsonages, you know they're probably not vast estates. So the word mansion doesn't occur, yet here we go, putting it on all the songs. I've got a mansion over the hilltop and all this sort of thing. And everybody thinks they're going to get a marble palace up there. And I want to know who's going to run the vacuum cleaner, who's going to mow the lawn. That may seem a little banal to you, but it's true that this, you know, we get ourselves all fouled up in this, and yet there are people that would like my hide because I talk like that. Because I'm shattering their illusions about their nice little Disneyland in the sky. And you can get tired of Disneyland pretty fast. Some of us do. I know people today still go to Disneyland, you know. 50 years later, they're still going there. But I guess it hasn't been around that long. But anyway, people like that kind of thing, but it's because they have a different perspective. The day will come when we finally quit this earth and we're in our spiritual state, well, we won't think about whether it's a mansion or not. We'll have a whole new orientation about things. But the consolation is that it really won't matter what it is, because our attitude will be different to what it ought to be. Like most things, they never really are quite what we think they're going to be. Even marriages like that. People get married and they have these illusions about the whole thing and their little Disneyland. We have one coming up, so I just threw that little thing in there, though. But it's true of life. This is very practical. And so if we're pinning a whole lot on what heaven's going to be like. Now, what does all this have to do with what I've been saying? Well, this very point, that our true sense of God and understanding of God is in the spirit inside of us. And there we have sort of a gut feeling about, or a gut sense of God and what he is and who he is. And often our human images get distorted. So whereas many things in the Bible are explicit and we can depend on our understanding of them pretty much, there are some things that are not that explicit and we have to depend on something deeper. And that's this book of Ezekiel, I'm coming back to that, has in it, it's the writings of the prophet Ezekiel, who had his visions of God, or his revelations of God, he puts it in language that is difficult to understand. But the overall picture here is an impression of God and not a precise statement about God. So in this vision of Christ, or vision of God in the book of Ezekiel, he talks about what his vision was like, and he speaks of the creatures that he saw. He saw a sort of a collage of images that were not to be taken as actual images, but as an impression of things. And each of these impressions were symbolic. So, for example, he said they had the face of a man, the face of a lion, the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. Now, that isn't to mean you've got a being here who's got four sides to him with all these faces. Those are symbolic. Remember that we talked about the expressionistic art versus representational. Of course, that's the 20th century application of art, you know, expressionistic. You may be familiar with the word impressionists. That was the old French school. Degas, Renoir, Monet. They were the impressionists. And what the impressionists were trying to do was to catch the feeling of what they were painting, the spirit of it, essence of it. But they didn't pay too much attention to detail, see. They wanted the essence. So when you get through with you see the painting, you have a feeling about it. But there's no precise delineation. Now the representationalist, on the other hand, paints an exact delineation, and the more skilled a representationalist is, the more precisely he paints, you see, so that you don't know whether it's a photograph or a painting. That's their ultimate goal. But the impressionist shuns that, or the expressionist. In the Bible, you have a lot of impressionism, you see. You have pictures like the one I just read to you that give you a sense of what God is like, but not a literal image. So you see, you get the feeling from this expression that God has a human side in the face of the man, a sense of man. On the other hand, he has the regal and sovereign sense of the lion. At the same time, there is the soaring vista of the eagle seeing the broader picture. And then you have the image of the ox, possibly a prefiguring of the sacrifice, but perhaps more likely the substance of the labor, the activity, the effort put forth to take care of the business of caring for the universe. The ox, the work animal. These are the aspects. At the same time, even the ox as a work animal is a sacrifice, because the ox gives itself for the service of the owner, you see. You've got that sacrificial service aspect of the interaction of God with man, you see. Now, those are vignettes, little pictures. And we don't nail anything down there and say, this is what God is. But we have a sense of what we can expect from God, that he is the caretaker of this universe. And as such, he has the human side and the regal side, the sovereign side and the service side and the visionary side, the overseership of things, as with the eagle. Well, I'm going to have to stop there.